A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is David.
It's August. It's kind of hard to believe we're at the start of August. Just by the way, August is a very tricky month in financial markets. So just watch this.
Two of the last really massive crises in financial markets began in August. The emerging market crisis of 1998, which ended up engulfing the entire Asian economy, then the Russian economy, then massive default, then a thing called LTCM, which was allegedly a foolproof fund run not by one, but two Nobel Prize winners for economics, blew up as a result of things that happened in August 1998. And then August 2007, far away in the subprime underbelly in Arizona, a couple of funds run by an outfit called Bear Stearns, one of America's significant, what they call bulge bracket banks, one of their funds started to show signs of distress in August 2007. And we know by March 2008, that bank Bear Stearns was gone, Lehman was gone 6 months later, and the world was in a massive financial crisis by August, September 2008. So August is a strange month. Don't want to be downer. Don't want to start freaking you out. But just be aware that financial crises and the dog days of summer at the end of August tend to come together. Of course, who is chuckling over here as I give my big speeches, my friend, Mr. Davis? How you doing, my man?
Very good. It's also your birthday in August.
It is. That was a massive correlation between crisis, turbulence, and the fact that us Leos come into the world full of nonsense.
This is your midlife crisis,
This is my midlife emerging market crisis. This is my massive midlife crisis. What's the crack, son?
Yeah, it's all good. Although, woke up this morning to the sad news of passing of John Hume, a colossal in Irish politics.
Yeah, I think by far and away the most impressive political leader we've had in this country in 100 years.
Yeah.
I think there's no doubt in this. And
not many people would disagree with that.
You know, what John Hume achieved in the darkest, darkest days of this island's history.
Yeah.
And the fact that he kept nationalist Northern Ireland and therefore nationalist Ireland on some sort of straight and narrow. And the fact that he dealt with such courage and bravery with what was in a really nasty, nasty sectarian state.
He was incredibly tenacious and determined. And his whole vision of, you know, getting away from that orange or green, nationalist or unionist kind of thing, and trying to find a real workable alternative.
Yeah, it is amazing. And he did two things that I think were really significant. He Europeanized the Irish problem. He's a big believer in the European Union. And the European Union gave people from Northern Ireland an identity which you didn't really have to. You could be European, and European diluted the sort of harshness of Irish and Britishness.
Mm.
And it gave this European angle. And then I think, of course, in the United States, he operated behind the scenes extraordinarily.
Absolutely. There's an amazing, I don't know if you've seen it, there's an absolutely incredible documentary called In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America, written and directed by a guy called Morris Fitzpatrick.
I haven't seen it.
You have, if you want to know anything about John Hume, you got to see this. I'm sure they'll be showing it again in light
of this. It's called John Hume in America.
It's called In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. And it's terrific. And the big thing about that was it tells the story of how he had the vision and the foresight to see if we're going to change things politically in Northern Ireland, we need to get outside help, essentially. And he went to America. He told a story of Ireland and got the political weight of American politicians, both Democrat and Republican.
They eventually called them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which was the Democrat and Republican four big beasts that together with Clinton drove the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
There's no doubt of that.
Yeah.
And kind of bullied the Brits also into realising that they had to do a deal.
Yeah.
And when I say bullied, just encouraged Britain to say, hold on a second, this is an international conflict and this can only be solved by an international treaty.
Yeah.
You know, so it is. But what I want to talk to you about is another part of John Hume's legacy that I think people don't really give him enough credit for, and that is the establishment of the credit unions in Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
John Hume established the first credit union in Ireland called the Derry Credit Union in 1960.
Okay.
Now, credit unions subsequently, North and South, have been the main financer, the main source of credit of poor people who couldn't get bank accounts because they weren't respectable enough. And in the old days, the banking system was very much part of the power struggle and the power system of the country, and only the decency could get a loan, right? And Hume understood that credit unions, that access to credit and finance was part of the whole civil rights movement. It was as important as access to education.
Right.
And there's a beautiful story about the Undertones, right?
Oh, yeah.
Lovely story about the Undertones, the role of John Hume in the Undertones. There's a great book by Mickey Bradley, who was the bass player of the Undertones,
about the
history of the Undertones. So I'm taking you back to June the 15th, 1978.
Oh, I was 12.
Imagine that. Imagine that we were both 12, right? Now, the scene is the Battle of the Bands in Belfast, organised by Terry Hooley, the legendary head of Good Vibrations Records.
Yeah.
The Undertones are a Derry band. Not only are there two brothers, but Billy Doherty and Fergal Sharkey are cousins. Like, this is how close the bands are, right?
Yeah.
So they're all from the same neck of the woods, right? Mickey Bradley is the bass guitarist. SLF, Stiff Little Fingers, were the band to beat. They were the band of the North, right?
Yeah, they'd set the bar.
They just released Suspect Device. Yeah. They had their own record label. How radical was that? They were proper punks, right? And they had an option for a deal with Rough Trade Records.
Yeah.
Rough Trade Records being Rough Trade Records. And of course, the Undertones, being from Derry, as Bradley said, they didn't really look to Belfast. They always looked to Dublin for their inspiration.
Yeah.
Belfast was a bit too different for them, etc. Right? Dublin was their neck of the woods. But they knew they had to make it in Belfast, and they knew that Stiff Little Fingers were the band that they had to emulate. So they grudgingly went to see Stiff Little Fingers in Kelly's in Portrush, which is a legendary nightclub in the north. It is a legendary nightclub in the northwest. You might not have heard of it.
I haven't, I'm
but
afraid.
But it's a kick-ass happening place, stonking place, Kelly's, right? And so Bradley tells the story, but they managed to blag their way on to the bill.
Right.
Now, the bill, headlining the bill are the Outcasts. The Outcasts were a skinhead band from Belfast that I remember seeing as the backup band Clash in the SFX.
Right, okay.
This is when I was in my Blackrock College blazer.
Yes, of course.
The Clash. Exactly. Ooh, punk. Yeah, anyway,
you
right.
You got wedgied on the way out.
Yeah, hard, you know, getting 40 shades kicked out of you on the way out. But the story is beautiful because it links John Hume. Bradley said they blagged their way onto the bill. They were in Derry. Mm. The problem is Billy Doherty, the drummer, had no drums.
Right.
Hit no drums.
That's a bit of a problem.
It's a bit of a problem. So how are they going to get the drums? And and of course, the band were poor.
Yeah.
And Bradley had become a member of the credit union when he was a kid because his parents were members of the credit union. Right.
Yeah.
So it'd save a little bit. Bradley goes down to the credit union. And because his whole family were members of the credit union, the credit union guy in the Derry credit union, the manager, gives Mickey Bradley, and he says in the book, 400 quid rolled up in tenors, which he stuffed down the front of his Wrangler jeans, and as he quotes, in case there would be highwaymen on the bogside that might meet him on the way home, right? So what you see is the Undertones end up going to Belfast as a result of the loan they get from the Derry Credit Union, which they would not have got had John Hume not set it up. And the rest is history. They record Teenage Kicks. John Peel picks it up.
Yeah.
And away they go. But let me come back to the Credit Union.
That's a fantastic
story. It's a great story, isn't it? Yeah, right?
That's brilliant.
So this is the stuff you get in this podcast. But let's come back to the Credit Union. That is exactly why Hume set up the Credit Union. Because Hume understood that one of the great sectarian instruments to be used against the Catholic population was not only no access to housing or education, but to credit.
Right.
Because credit does an amazing thing, John. Credit allows you to live in the future. And I know sometimes this is weird because we always talk about too much credit and spending credit badly. But what credit does is it allows you to dream about a possible future. It allows you to postpone.
Yeah.
This is critical because if you can say, well, maybe next year I might go to college and I can plan for going to college and I can save money and these people are going to give me credit. I mean, Bradley refers to the credit unions as a community bank in Derry for Catholics. It's exactly the same down here. You talk to lots and lots of people from backgrounds where there wasn't much money. And the credit union paid for education.
Yeah.
The credit union paid for
all sorts
of stuff.
It's like those kind of microfinancing systems that I've seen at work in India.
You're absolutely right.
And they work fantastically well.
Really fascinating thing about microfinancing is that there was a guy called Muhammad Yunus who won a Nobel Prize not long after John Hume won the Nobel Prize.
Okay.
For him setting up a bank called the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which was a microfinance bank that lent very small amounts of money to very poor women.
Yeah.
What he understood was one thing, it's quite interesting, that poor people do not default. Rich people default. People like Donald Trump default. That's the truth, right?
Yeah.
If you look at all the great defaulters, they were always rich.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Poor people pay their debts. And the crazy thing about it is because of the class system, people like Donald Trump get very low interest rates when they borrow lots of money. And very poor women in Bangladesh were suffering under very high interest rates from moneylenders.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Even though the risk of default is much higher on the rich guy. Look at all the guys who defaulted in Ireland in the...
Yeah,
in the,
yeah absolutely. Yeah,
they were all rich guys,
yeah.
Right? Poor guys don't default. Poor people don't default. But what John Hume understood, and it's critical, and the Undertones is a lovely story of that, is that if you give poor people access to small amounts of credit, 100 quid, 200 quid, 300 quid, it changes the way in which they look at the future. You know, I've always thought that poverty is really about time horizons.
Yes, yeah.
That the problem with poor people is they can't see beyond tomorrow because they have to generate cash today. But if you give that poor person credit for tomorrow, okay, if you say you don't have to pay your university fees today or whatever you have to, but you can pay it over a 10-year period and we'll give you credit, suddenly the world opens up. So, and I think this is how economies change. Economies don't change with some great big bang. They change by step, little by little. People buying a drum kit.
Yeah.
You know, really?
Yeah.
Because that created one of the greatest bands ever come out here. It wouldn't have happened had they not bought the drum kit, right? People buying a little bit of education, maybe, you know, putting down, changing their house, maybe doing this, doing that. And it's all small because the economy starts from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Mm.
And when you get that right, and what John Hume understood in the 1950s was that Catholics didn't have access to credit, largely because, it's an unfortunate thing, Protestants ran the banks in Northern Ireland. So they wouldn't give Catholics credit. So the Catholics were depositing their money in the banks, but that money was disappearing out of the Catholic community.
Of course, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So John Hume said, look, what we'll do is we'll set up our own bank, like a cooperative bank.
Yeah.
Now, this goes back a long way. You know, the cooperative movement is part of the Irish national movement.
How do you mean?
Well, Horace Plunkett, did you ever hear Horace Plunkett?
I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, he set up the cooperative movement in Ireland at the start of the 20th century.
Okay.
And again, the same sort of idea that if you don't have much resources, if you pool your resources together, you'll get a better outcome.
Yeah.
That's the idea. So this is part of the whole... So Hume is... Before he even becomes the man we know, he's in a long line of people, of human rights activists who understood that banking and credit is a human right.
Yeah.
It's part of human rights. And that's, I would say, one of the longest lasting legacies. I mean, there's the Good Friday Agreement and there's all that, but these little small things are fascinating. And can you imagine Derry without the Undertones? It's like Derry without Derry City.
Yeah.
It's like Derry without, there's a great bar actually. I should take it.
Go on, I've never been to
there's
Derry.
There's a bar called the Sandero Bar in Water Street in Derry, right?
Yeah.
And it comes from Sandinista.
Oh, right.
The Sandinistas were Daniel Ortega's revolutionary Nicaraguan communist.
Yeah,
group,
it was all
right?
Essential American.
And you walk into that bar, right? I think it's called Sandista or Sandero. People from Derry will pick us up on this, right? You walk in and you've got Nicaragua Libra and you've got Fidel Castro and Bolivian revolutionaries and Hasta la Revolución Siempre, all these great slogans. Like, it is like going into and Palestinian flags, and it's like going into a revolutionary cell.
Right.
But it's a boozer.
Yeah.
And every time I'm in Derry, which is not as often as we should do, a show from Derry, I've gone in there for a quick scoop or two. And it's a different, because Derry's a political city.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's
a
city defined by civil rights. There are highly, highly attuned political people. And, you know, Hume didn't come from nowhere. He's part of the firmament.
Absolutely.
And the credit union movement all over Ireland is due to John Hume. He set it all up. And when I hear about John Hume's passing, I think it's not just the big things he did, but the small things he did that changed people's lives completely. People like Mickey Bradley, the bass guitarist of the Undertones.
Well, let's have a quick listen. So, Mac, and another big event that happened this week, of course, was Mr. Mac Williams being ranked fifth in the most influential economists in the world, like ever.
Like ever? it came out of the blue. It's great. It came out of the blue. It's a ranking of the most influential economists in the world. I mean, Paul Krugman was number one, so, you know, that's always good
to
see.
Stiglitz was number six.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you now, Joe, you just have to pull up. No, but so what it is a ranking about where people go to get their economics. So it's publications, it's articles, maybe podcasts.
Yeah.
All this sort of who influences most people. And I think it's really flattering to come in. It's great. It is good. And it's, I suppose, John, it's what we're trying to do here. You're trying to use all the mediums, you know, whether it's a blogs or podcasts or articles or Kilconomics or all these things that I've ended up kind of falling into because I couldn't get a proper job. I couldn't hold down a proper job.
Didn't plan anything.
Exactly. There's no plan. And again, it's really gratifying. So it's great,
play to you. I think it's great.
Yeah, no, it is good. But I was down in Roundstone when I got that message.
Right.
And of course, you like Roundstone.
It's one of my favourite places in the whole world.
I love Roundstone. And of course, I was married there.
Yes,
you happened to give a speech at the wedding.
As far as I remember.
Yeah. It was one of those weddings. So it's really, you know, it was nice. So we went back to the little church. There's a little church called St. Mary's that actually leaked. Do you remember? Because it lashed rain.
It did.
A hole in the roof and it leaked and the whole altar was all rain was lashing in the whole thing. It's coming out the back. But anyway, I was down in Ranstone. And interesting, you know, we were talking about John Hume just there.
Yeah.
And the role of credit unions in the liberating of the nationalist mind about the possibilities that you could actually avail of if you could get these small finances. I was also thinking about that in the context of what happened in and around the Roundstone area about 100 years ago, maybe 120 years ago, where huge tracts of land were made available to the Irish tenants from the landlords. Again, a bit like John Hume, through financial innovation.
Right.
You know, as I'd like to say, it was really bonds, not bombs, that generated Ireland's freedom.
Right, okay.
And again, I was...
Nice. I like that.
Yeah, it is, but it's true, because you know, in history, we never look at the economics. You always think about the big patriot giving the speech at the dock,
yeah,
or the big mass movement and the big event, the war, the this, that, and the other, the rise in the revolution. They're all really important things. But underlying these things are movements in economics and finance and money.
The day-to-day stuff.
The day-to-day stuff. And maybe, John, the day-to-day stuff, the little incremental stuff, makes a much bigger impact on the overall end game than the big events, because it's the little things that change people's lives. And it's when people's lives change that the world changes.
Brilliant. Well, let's get into that.
The Irish summer is hard to love. I mean, it is. Yeah. I was walking there yesterday and there's a lovely walk down the bog road. And you're kind of thinking it's kind of comical because you're walking in a biblical deluge.
Mm.
It's coming down sideways at you. It's like hitting you, right?
Yeah.
And you're thinking, I'm paying for the pleasure of this spiteful deluge down on top of me. But what intrigued me, John, was walking through, we mentioned it last week in terms of La Hinch, walking through areas of Connemara.
Yeah.
And that sense of the emptiness and the stillness and the lack of humanity.
Mm.
And then you think back to history. And you think there was a time when this part of the country was hugely populated.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
In fact, in the early part of the 19th century, so from, let's say, the Napoleonic Wars up until the famine, the west of Ireland was the fastest growing population of anywhere in Europe. And European population was growing rapidly then.
Really?
Yeah. And you also think there was an extraordinary displacement of people. So Irish place names are very revealing because they tell you things about the landscape and the people that you're not really too sure of. So I was walking on this walk and I was walking through a sort of a townland called Kukla. And then I asked one of the locals the other day, and I've been reading a guy called Tim Robinson, who's written all these brilliant...
Not the actor.
No, he's a cartographer.
He okay.
Passed away.
Oh, lovely.
Beautiful maps of Connemara. Mm. Very interesting. And Kukla means Cúige Ulla from the Irish... Cúige Ulla, like Mincher Ulla, the people of Ulster. And these were people who were displaced, think about this, in the Cromwellian, the pre-Cromwellian, the plantations of Ulster, 1650, 16 around then. And those Cúige Ulla were people from Ulster who were displaced, who, think about it, were dispossessed from their lands and then ended up in the most barren, unappealing.
Why did they go there? Why did they choose
Because
that?
The hell are Connacht. Remember, right. Cromwell said, "Put a hell or conch," and Kukla is evidence of this, because the local people, they arrived, and imagine they would be all speaking Irish, but they would speak sort of Ulster Irish, more like Donegal Irish, which is quite different to...
Wouldn't know.
I know. I'll tell you all about that in a while. Right? It was quite different to Connemara Irish, right?
Yeah.
And of course, their accents would have been different. They would have used different words. And so their area, and like anything, you would have arrived in with maybe 10 families, and you hang out together. And this was Cúige Ulla.
Right.
Now known as Kukla, this is where the people from Ulster who were dispossessed ended up around Roundstone.
Okay.
And I was thinking of this, how did it all change? Because I was going back to history. 1903, the Windham Land Act, right?
Well, actually, hang on. Before you get there, did the place not empty out as a result of the famine first?
Absolutely. So it fills up before the famine.
Yeah.
It empties out after the famine.
Yeah.
But still, you have a very, very intensely populated areas. There's a thing called the Congested Districts Board, which was a thing that the Brits brought in, we were told was killing home rule with kindness. And Roundstone is one of those. So Roundstone was built by Scottish engineers.
Right.
Now, why? Because the idea was the Brits went into the congested districts, the districts that were congested. Mm. Because it was still huge, huge peasant Irish farmers there.
Yeah.
And massive landlords. And they said, we're going to build infrastructure for these people. And this, in a way, is going to wean them off Irish nationalism because, you know, we can see that the British government did this, that, and the other, right? So you see this incredibly congested district still all over Connemara, all over the west coast of the country. And what struck me then was, given that the concentration of land ownership was so extraordinary. There were 900 landlords and they controlled 1.5 million acres.
Wow.
Right? Which is one third of the total acreage of Galway was controlled by 900 people. Some of them had extraordinary, extraordinary landholdings. So, for example, you know Ballinahinch Castle?
Yeah, beautiful, yeah.
Right, so Ballinahinch Castle was home to a fellow called Richard Berridge.
Yeah.
And as late as 1903, that's not that long ago, right? I mean, yeah. Our grandparents were probably born around then, right?
Yeah.
Your man owned 160,000 acres.
Wow.
At that time,
wow.
The average income of the average Irish tenant on his land was £5 a year. So Jeez. Imagine that concentration of wealth. Now, what has struck me...
Not only that, it is possibly the most beautiful place in the country.
Yeah.
For to own all of that.
If you're on a horse, not if you're digging spuds.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
But absolutely. So what interests me was how did the British government achieve the social revolution that was the transfer of land during the Land Acts from British or Irish, Anglo-Irish aristocracy to these peasants that had no money? Because if at the time the British landlords, all of whom were supported by the House of Lords, all of whom were related to or mates of the Lords, and many of them had actually positions in the Lords, they wanted compensation. They weren't going to give up their land. The Irish peasants had no money. So how did the Brits achieve this? This was always intrigued me.
Yeah.
Even when I was doing history in school, I thought, something wrong here, right?
Yeah, there seemed to be a kind of a jump. Gap.
You know, how can you get a transfer of assets from the very rich to the very poor in a deal that suits everyone?
Yeah. So how did that happen?
This is what I want to talk about. It's the magic of the bond market.
The old bonds.
Right? And again, it's something that we don't understand or we don't appreciate, is that when you use finance and economics constructively, you can achieve amazing things. So let me, before we talk about Ireland, let me go back to the slave, because it's quite the opposite at the moment.
Yeah.
How did the Brits end the slave trade? Now, given that they started it, right?
Yeah.
But how did they end it? And how they ended it was the following. They compensated all slave owners, which is extraordinary. So the British government raised a bond.
Yeah.
They went out and said, we are going to abolish slavery, but we are going to compensate slave owners for the confiscation of their property, which were the humans.
Wow.
Think about it.
Yeah.
And they raised a perpetual bond. And they just raised money and they gave the money to the slave owners and they freed the slaves.
Have you any idea how much they paid?
I have not, but we can check it. We can double check it and we can come back to that.
That's amazing.
Isn't it?
It's incredible, yeah.
So then once they did this, the Brits figured out we can do the same with the Irish.
Mm.
We can raise a bond in order to do the following. The bond is what we will give the landlords. The landlords then have a government-backed bond, which they can either cash in or they can hold on to. And what we will do is we will ask the peasants who have no money to pay between 2 and 4% interest every year. And they pay that interest. So no money changes hands. This is the fascinating thing, right? And the Irish peasants paid 2 to 4% interest on these bonds. The bonds were 70 years. They were actually for 68 years. And that was calculated because it meant that it would skip a generation. So what happens then, they're only paying the interest.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
So the payments then went into a fund, and then that fund was dipped into to pay the annuities, biannual annuities to the landlords.
Okay, right.
So the question then is, this is quite amazing. What the Brits managed to do was, they managed with, of course, the Land League and the Irish Parliamentary Party and all those guys. You know, basically Parnell's party. Parnell and Gladstone began this process and the Land Acts then, but we don't learn how they were all financed. And they were financed by the bond market.
Right.
So the Brits, therefore, figured out a way of giving the Irish peasants what they wanted, which was ownership of the land.
Yeah.
Therefore, giving people a stake in the country, right? While at the same time, giving the landlords an exit strategy, which means they could actually leave Ireland, which they wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole idea was to promote home rule, not to promote an independent Irish Republic. But the figures are fascinating, the extent to which the land transfer. So if you look at maps of Ireland in the 1880s, you see a tiny, tiny percentage of peasant farmers, of tenants, owning land.
Yeah.
By 1913, that has changed dramatically. And the vast majority of Irish land is owned by Irish people.
Wow.
And this was facilitated by the Brits issuing these long-term bonds. And this, the lesson for us now, is that you can achieve enormous social reforms.
Yeah.
By using the bond markets. What the bond market does is it reduces the cost today of a massive objective tomorrow. And when you're walking through Roundstone, you think, that's what happened. It was real. It actually happened. And it's financial engineering in its most beautiful and constructive form.
Yeah, the way it should be.
Yeah.
But hang on a second. That 2.5 to 4% that the peasants are paying back in interest.
Yeah.
What was that in real value for them? That was easily affordable.
It was easily affordable because it's a very low rate of interest.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
What's going on at the time is the gold standard. The gold standard, the late 19th century, early 20th century, was a period of very low international inflation.
Right.
So interest rates were very low and very stable. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is prior to that, there was no banking system in Ireland for Irish tenant farmers.
Right.
So this is the interesting thing. How they managed to create a financial architecture without having financial architecture.
Mm.
Because prior to that, John, the main money lenders in Ireland to the Irish people were grocers.
Right? Well, yeah, okay.
Grocers, publicans and undertakers. That's why, you know, down the country.
Yeah.
You often see sometimes the same family. It's the grocer, the undertaker.
Yeah.
And the publican, right?
And up to quite recently, it was a place you'd go in and you'd cash your check as well.
Precisely. Why? Because they were originally moneylenders. So there's great literature on Irish shadow banking before we had banks, right?
Right.
And again, you know the expression, the Gombeen man?
Yes.
So the Gombeen man was hated because he was seen to be on the side of the landlords. Why is that? Which was that basically if somebody was evicted, they were likely to have been evicted at the end of a process of bankruptcy. The beginning of that process would have, they would have defaulted on the local grocer.
Right.
Okay. Who was the money lender in the village. And because the grocer's interest and the landlord's interest aligned, which was to keep the peasant farmers paying them a few quid, they became the Gombeen men. And in rural Ireland, you know, that still is a very loaded insult.
Yeah.
And they were largely grocers. And in fairness to the poor old grocers, they went bankrupt at a much higher rate than any other class in Ireland.
Of course.
Because they were defaulted on.
Yeah.
Because you get a bad harvest, you're defaulted on. So all this stuff is going on.
So were these bonds eventually paid back?
Well, now that's an interesting one. So the bonds allowed massive social reform.
Yeah.
Then we get independence. Then we get the Cumann and Gael government in the 1920s. That the Cumann and Gael government in the 1920s were basically keep everything on the straight and narrow. Let's kind of be independent, but pretend we're not independent.
Yeah.
So we kept sterling exchange rate. We kept very, very conservative economic policies, etc. Then De Valera gets in 1932. And the first thing he does is he defaults on all these bonds.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Ireland defaulted in the 30s, very early doors, very early on, because De Valera was doing two things. One, he was trying to outflank the old IRA by being more Republican and closer to the tenant farmers than anybody else, because he eventually ended up shooting his former comrades in the IRA.
Yes, yeah.
And in order to position himself like that, he had to be more green than anybody else. And of course, the open sewer for Irish people was that we were still paying English landlords after having got our independence.
Right, yes. Yeah,
so he said this was a strategic move on De Valera's part to position himself as the Green Republican.
Yeah.
The problem
was... Stick up the two fingers.
The problem was, of course, the Brits responded with a trade war.
Go on, yeah.
So think about what happened in Ireland. Ireland exported people and cattle in the 1930s, right? The Brits then responded, well, if you're not going to pay this, we're going to close our borders to your produce, which is what they would do.
Yeah.
What do we export? Cattle and people. So they allowed the people to leave, but they banned Irish exports to the United Kingdom. Now, of course, Dev spun this as plucky little Ireland up against the Brits. But what it caused was the precipitation of a massive, massive recession in this country, which would have happened anyway because the 1930s was recessionary all around the world.
But at that stage, was the UK not reliant on Ireland for a lot of the kind of dairy produce and farm produce?
Well, they could source things in the empire, which is why New Zealand became a massive producer of butter. Or Australia, a massive producer of wool and sheep.
They're over the other side of the world, though. Well, so the cost of that.
It's the Brexit question.
Yeah.
We're back to the Brexit question. Yeah. No, we'll do great trade with Argentina.
Yeah.
Why not do trade with us? We're down the road. But anyway, so the story of these bonds is the story of two things. One is how you can achieve great things by financial engineering. And two, how it has to feel right in order for people to keep paying. So there has to be a moral background noise to economics. And if the people feel that this is right and just, they will keep doing it. But what intrigues me and what's relevant for now is how we can use the bond market to do extraordinary things, because the bond market does is it allows you to buy now, pay later, in effect, right? So you get the social reform now and you pay later. And intriguingly, when you're looking at the history of Galway and you're looking at what actually happened to the sons and daughters of Irish tenants who acquired land in the early part of the century, there's an amazing study done by two sociologists, economists, Hannan and Cummings, which in a granular fashion asked the question, what tribe, what subsect of Irish society has done best from free education? Because at the time, the expectation was we brought in free education in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
And we would follow the British model. We would create an urban working class who became a middle class. That was the British model. So that's the Brian Eno, those sort of people, all the early 70s musicians came from the first class to go to art college. Like John Lennon, they go to art college.
Yeah.
They do things that their parents never did, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we thought we would create that in the urban class. But actually what happened in Ireland is the most successful people in Ireland are the sons and daughters of small farmers from Galway, and in particular, East Galway. That's the data. And that's amazing.
Why is that? How does that
work? So what happened was once the small farmers got a stake in the land, right, then they had a stake. They had a toehold in the society.
Yeah.
When free education comes in, something bizarre happens. Nobody predicted that the kids who would avail of free education and use it dramatically would be the sons and daughters of small farmers, not the sons and daughters of the urban working class, right? Basically the Dublin working class, right? What you see is the Dublin working class didn't avail of free education the same way. So what you see is they both start around the same income levels in the 1960s. By the 1980s, the sons and daughters of small farmers all around the country, but particularly in Galway, are miles ahead of everybody else. They become the sort of school teachers, civil servants of the 80s. Their kids are the doctors and lawyers, and they're the people who introduced GAA to South Dublin, right? When you go to the South Dublin GAA clubs, I mean, Coola is sponsored by Davies Stockbrokers, right?
Yeah.
Coola GAA. So what you see is massive upward social progression.
Yeah. I'll be a Croaks man myself.
You are a Croaks man. I know you're a Croaks man. But the grounding of all of this was in the innovation in the bond market at the beginning of the 20th century that allowed people to dream of owning their own plots, which they never had the money to do so, but the bond market allowed them to get that stake. And when you look at right now, John, the bond market is telling us, do it.
Yeah.
We can do so many things with it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So this is really interesting, this kind of financial engineering. But the one thing that I always hear when we're talking about ideas and what we should be doing, where we should be investing and how we should be spending the money is, who's going to pay for this? Somebody has to pay for it. Who's it going to be?
That's because you hang out with accountants. No, but accountants live in the real-time balance sheet, profit and loss on an annual basis, or assets and liabilities on an annual basis. The beauty of economics is that a lot of macroeconomics is about what they call the time value of money, which is the idea that money has a value through time.
Right.
This is why in the ancient world, the Catholic Church, all the Christian Church was very against lending and paying interest.
Right.
And the reason was because only God made time. And you couldn't put a price on time. That's Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, right?
Okay, yeah,
so it was this really very philosophical stuff about the notion of time. Who creates time?
Yeah.
So if you think there's a one creator, okay, that creates the future, right? The idea that some grubby little lender would be putting a price on that, saying, I'll give you 100 quid, but you've got to pay me 10% for the time value of money, right? So and that's why the church was against usury. That's why Islam is against usury. That's why it's not allowed in Islam to charge interest. It's called Islamic banking. You cannot charge interest.
Right.
So what they do is they put other charges in. So what the bond market allows you to do is it allows you to project forward the actual cost of doing something enormous today. So that allows you to do two things. One is it allows you to create money out of nothing.
Which
accountants can't figure out because they don't like that. Okay. Because it doesn't feel right. Okay. But the second thing.
Nothing becomes of nothing. Speak again, Cordelia.
Listen to you. Right.
Bit of King Lear there.
King Lear. So. But once you understand that what the bond market allows you to do is, so for example, in the case we're talking about, a 68-year bond, which tells the peasant farmer, you don't have to pay the principal back in total until 68 years, you solve the problem.
Yeah.
Because as Cain said, in the long run,
but somebody has to pay it back, we're all dead. Right?
Nobody has to pay back. That's the really interest. That's the key. That's what accountants don't get. And that's when you're sitting in the back of the boozer with your mates or anyone. And it feels, how can we, so for example, let's say we wanted to build 100,000 houses today.
Yeah, which we do.
Which we do, right? And we should build houses that should be not maybe free to people, but could only be charged an interest rate of 2%,
right?
At the moment, we've got this terrible charade that you've got to put up a deposit and that deposit's this, and you've got to go to the bank and you've got to pay bank charges. You don't have to do any of that stuff. The government just raises a bond, right?
Yeah.
Of 100 million, 200 million, 300 million, whatever size the figure is.
Mm.
And you create a mortgage that excludes the banks and its relationship between you and the government, like your tax bill.
Right.
So you borrow for 100 years at 0%, which we can do now, which Austria did last week, and you build. There is no financial constraint. In the same way as when the Wyndham Land Act was going through the Parliament in England in 1903, the discussion wasn't about who's going to pay for this. The discussion was about, are we going to achieve our objective, which is social land reform in Ireland to address Irish concerns about their own position?
Right.
Once you begin to dream about the big things, you realize that of all the obstacles that you can put up to social reform, in a world of zero interest rates, money is not one of them. And that's the key. Over the last couple of months, you've asked, could we get our academic courses, the online course, the Ask Mac tutorials, CPD, i.e., could you get points for continuous professional development as part of your own career development? I'm delighted to say, yes, indeed. Coming up from the 1st of September, our courses will be CPD applicable. You'll be able to get points on all the courses. We're going to give the details. Watch this space, but I think it's a really exciting development. Talk to you soon.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.